I put a couple of Greek words up here on the board as a kind of review of what we had said in our previous presentation about sin and sickness. It's a very strange thing about the New Testament that the usual Greek words for health or being well are used very rarely. Hygieis, from which we have hygienics, occurs really only once in the story of the healing of the blind man, and Luke has the verb hygieino, to make well, at one place. The usual word is zozein, which of course has in it, within it, the meaning not only of health, but of salvation. And one of the points we were trying to make in our previous presentation was underlining the fact that healing is this end of salvation. There's an interconnection between the two. Medical ethics, as such, is of course concerned with man, his maladies, and the kind of healing that is proffered to him. And it is also deeply interested in the question of understanding what health is in the first place. But before going to a discussion of the concept of health, maybe it will be helpful to try to analyze somewhat and diagnose man's present malady. And if there is one word that applies almost universally, it is the fact that man lives really in isolation. That's one of his chief problems. This is true in spite of the fact that there are more of us than ever before. There are over 4 billion of us occupying this planet at the moment. Despite the crowding, there is a haunting loneliness that troubles people, partly because men are so hollow on the inside. Way back in the 20s already, when Gertrude Stein did her autobiography, she commented on the many intellectuals that she had met in Paris, that they, quote, suffered from nothingness, unquote. Most people suffering from this kind of malady have attempted to live as though the Christian religion were a kind of negligible, peripheral, marginal hypothesis with no particular connection to the realities of life. And I suppose if you limit yourself to the superficialities, which are often propounded as though they were the Christian religion, there might be some truth in that particular stance. But anyone who believes that the Christian religion or the biblical revelation has very little to do with the realities of life ought to take up a little book like the prophet Habakkuk and find out how questions are properly raised and answered. Coming back to the basic thesis that man's chief malady today is isolation, I think we can recognize in his experience that he's trapped with his gadgets. He's got all kinds of them. Time-saving devices, presumably, except that they give you less time than you had before. And I'm sure you must also have heard the story of the man who came home from his office all tired, more tired than he had ever looked before, and his wife asked him, "For goodness sake, what happened?" And he said, "Well, today the computers broke down, and we all had to go to work and do some thinking." That's part of the consequence of our computerized and mechanized society. It puts man into isolation, but there are deeper reasons for it than that. They reach back into our history. We suffer in part from a false dualism, which we actually inherited in our culture from the Greeks. And the man who's usually blamed for this is Plato, and perhaps properly so. He created a dichotomy between man's body, which is material, and his soul. He figured that the greatest disaster which had ever happened in the universe was the creation of material things. For him, the human body was a prison for the soul. And there are two words that he liked to use. The body is sema, a tomb. For the body is a tomb. Soma, body, is a tomb for the soul. And the happiest experience to look forward to is the release of the soul from the body. Where you deal with that kind of dualism, you, of course, destroy man's totality. Fortunately, the biblical revelation doesn't create that kind of dichotomy. It insists that God is the creator as well as the redeemer. And when Paul had to deal with this question in Colossae, in that strange Irish stew, the Colossian heresy, this is the point he made. These people too insisted with the Gnostics that matter is evil, and therefore the best recourse is to either get rid of the body by living it upright or by asceticism keeping it under control. And it is in that epistle where Paul twice uses a combination of words he never used anywhere else, namely that Jesus became incarnate, Jesus Christ became incarnate in the sarks of the soma. And his argument is that God is the creator as well as the redeemer. He is the redeemer and creator. There is no room in the biblical revelation for this kind of dichotomy or separation between soul and body as though they were operated on two levels and were of different interests to the creator. The second major factor in the development of a culture where man lives in such dreadful isolation is the notion that truth can be determined only by empirical observation. And this has led to a notion of life which looks at it only in terms of breadth and length and really doesn't know how to deal with the problem of meaning, of depth. And the result of this is something like you would get if you took a Mercator map, the two-dimensional map that used to be in old geography books, and believe that this actually represents the globe. What you need is a polar map in order to get the full dimensions of this little planet on which we live. And as a result of this emphasis on empirical observation, life has become a sum of disconnected data. You add them up, but there's no particular score. You just engage in some arithmetic and statistics. Not so long ago, I came across a French book done by Marc Saporta. It's called Composition Number One. The pages are not numbered. The reason for it is very simple. The author wants you to put the pages together the way you want. You put the meaning into the book by numbering the pages properly. As you know, modern art works very much that in that same way. If you would ask an artist what a picture means, he would say, "What do you mean? It's not supposed to mean anything. You're supposed to figure out what it represents." So that man, in this view of life, is reduced to an aggregate of several trillions of cells, each one of which represents an assemblage of different molecules and ultimately electrons. And out of that kind of pursuit of truth, there eventually develops what was the theme for the Dachau camp, the inscription over the door, "Here there is no God." And that's the climate within which a German Dr. Koch, for instance, could do all kinds of experiments on human beings as though they were no more than rats. Now, happily, some of our counterculture has taken issue with this view of man and this type of culture. A lot of our young people are interested in Oriental mysticism, partly because it provides a kind of counterbalance to this kind of technocratic measurement of life in terms of empirical data. The third ingredient I suppose one would need to add is that of an exaggerated individualism. This began with the Renaissance, shall we say, roughly speaking, when Descartes observed cogito ergo sum. He was implying that since I can think as an autonomous unit, I can really sit and view other things objectively. And here's where you get this whole distinction between subjective and objective, which is completely foreign to the biblical notion of truth and unintelligible even to the Oriental today. He cannot imagine himself sitting apart, disconnected from whatever he is viewing or looking at or studying. The biblical revelation is quite foreign to this notion. Wheeler Robinson's little pamphlet on corporate personality is worth reading at that point. It indicates that the scriptures do not deal with the person just as an individual all by himself, an isolated unit, one more unit of energy or matter in movement, to quote Mao Zedong. On the contrary, it views man in terms of his corporate belonging. In Romans 5, we have the famous passage which we use to talk about original sin. What the passage really says is that when Adam sinned, we were there. This is not something that was transmitted like a virus from generation to generation, although that's the way we sometimes talk about it. What the Greek text says in the F-ho, if I might write that out, is that in Adam's transgression, we were present. We shared in that act. We belong to him. And now on that basis, you see, St. Paul can say in Romans 6 that we become part of the new humanity by baptism in Jesus Christ. The malady then, let us say, is that of isolation. Now our theology can meet this malady head on. Man has pretty well exhausted his options. He's been trying every tunnel and every hole in search of some cure for his isolation, and he's running out of possibilities. What he experiences is something like what used to be said of apples that grew at the Dead Sea. They look beautiful on the outside, you bite into them and they turn into ashes. Men thought that science could set them free, only to discover that it enslaves them. Man desires world peace, and what happens is we sell more armaments than ever before. $200 billion worth a year. We develop nuclear energy, but out of it comes the evil of the atom bomb, or even the nuclear bomb, the cobalt bomb even. Biblical theology has made us aware of the degree to which man is dealt with in terms of his solidarity, and now we're getting back to those words again, totality, continuity, and community. And the full proclamation of the gospel will help us to see, once again, that the congregation can be a therapeutic community and make a very special contribution just to this problem of our age. The other day I got hold of a lecture that Bishop Leslie Newbegin delivered on 17th January. It doesn't say where he delivered it, but he has a number of observations here which I should just like to read. They're very brief. Here's one of them. If you think only of the individual human body as the object of healing, then it's difficult to see that the Christian congregation has any significant role to play. But if the object of healing is the community, when you can see that the Christian congregation, which is also a kind of community, is a proper vis-a-vis for the community, the wider community as a whole, then you get some notion of the biblical idea of health. Or here again, page 5 of that particular lecture. Health in the Christian understanding is a continuous and victorious encounter with the powers that deny the existence and goodness of God. We tried to say that in the previous lecture. This is part of the kingdom of Satan. It is a participation in an invasion of the realm of evil in which the final victory lies beyond death, that the power of that victory is known now in the gift of the life-giving Spirit. And so it will be helpful for us to spend this particular period, the rest of it, looking at what health is in terms of the scriptural revelation. And I'm going to use a great deal of a paper I once prepared for the second Tübingen consultation on healing and salvation. There were two of them. Bishop Leslie Newbegin was at the first one, and a number of the rest of us were in the second one. And the title of this particular presentation that I prepared for that consultation is Health. What is it? And if I read a good bit here, it's because this thing was rather tightly written, since we did not have as much time as we should like to have had. So let me begin. One has only to glance through the pages of any popular journal to realize how much time and energy people are devoting to the pursuit of health as the possession of a complete and developed physique. How many people have you seen jogging lately? That's what they're interested in. They are pursuing health in terms of physique and physical conditioning. Yet all of us know of instances within the range of our own experience or that of immediate acquaintances which seriously challenge this concept and acutely raise the question of the nature of health. Now, the issue is not a new one. In the city of Pericles and in the Republic of Augustus, men went through much of the same ritual prescribed by the rubrics of present-day clubs devoted to the cult of health. If you ever gone to see the ruins of Pompeii and Herculaneum, you'll see all kinds of evidences for the devotion to this cult. They still pursue the ideal of being physically fit as though it belonged to the ultimate values of life. On this point, the gospel is quite explicit in its insistence that devotion to what is at best now, a penultimate goal, as though it belonged to the realm of the ultimates, is idolatry. Whether such practice occurred in ancient days or is pursued in our own midst and in our own culture. Clubhouses of the kind described may be, for all practical purposes, if we can put it that way, the contemporary equivalents of the temples once erected in honor of Apollo or Venus or Asclepius, shall we say. The cult of health is practiced at times on the basis of a hierarchy of values created by implications derived from a view of life which looks on man as little more than an object of experiment and observation consisting of muscles and limbs and cells and such chemical ingredients as keep these various items working together in some reasonable fashion. This reductionist philosophy builds on the long-established but short-sighted practice of sundering soul from body, or spirit from body, to use the biblical terminology, and then ignoring the former on the assumption that it cannot be dealt with empirically anyway, so why bother? In such an interpretation of life, the gospel addresses itself with a reminder that man does not live by bread alone. It insists now, as it did in the days of St. Paul, that man cannot be understood except in his totality, there we go again, and that the issue of health must necessarily encompass his whole being. For God is the creator of the total man, and not one hair from his head falls from his head without the knowledge of our Father in heaven. Old as it is, the problem of health has become more acute in our day because new factors have been introduced into the formula. We may refer to these as items of discontinuity. In a sense, these make of health a new question for the church as we know it. We might name as the first of these factors the creation and availability of many kinds of drugs to shield people from pain, to settle their nerves, and even expand the limits of their experience by the mysterious effects of LSD and its equivalents. These various possibilities heighten the temptation to think of health in terms of biochemical fulfillment. To help man recognize the idolatrous and even demonic aspects of this new situation, the gospel intends to recall us to the insight that man is not to be understood as being a rather sophisticated bundle of energy whose effectiveness is determined by the achievement and retention of chemical balance, or changing the chemical balance, as we read even in the case of athletes. It goes on to suggest that health may best be thought of, and here is the basic definition, that condition which enables the individual to function within a cosmic context for the well-being of others. Conversely, the scriptures keep saying that man is ill to the degree that he lacks the ability and opportunity to exercise this responsibility in freedom. Now, we don't want to get caught in the Marxist trap at this point and insist that man is ill to the extent that he is alienated from himself and has to eliminate all these bothersome things like a belief in God. Unfortunately, that's the way some segments in the church or in Christendom have taken. We didn't go that far in Tübingen. In fact, we tried to avoid that particular pitfall. The whole problem has become even more complex because of the developments in medical technology. These provide instruments of extraordinary precision and exceptional penetration, particularly into the physical dimensions of illness. The very existence of such resources invests their application with a quality of ambivalence. Putting it another way, the products of this kind of inventiveness wear two faces. On the one hand, they can help to alleviate pain and suffering, but on the other, they confront men with the temptation to view the task of healing only as a matter of scientific challenge. As a matter of fact, the advances in medical technology have become so great that medicine has become part of the terror of humanity, being able to keep individuals alive who are no longer really persons. And Karen Quinlan, for instance, has become a household word for just this type of terror inherent in the advances of medical technology. Add to this the size of the resources available to certain areas of the world, and we reach a moment in history when the very fabric in a given situation is changed by the enticing prospect of engaging in the restoration to health without even bothering to know the person under treatment. It can be done as part of the thingification of man, or if you like a bigger word, reification. At this juncture, the gospel intrudes with a reminder that man was created for relationship and not for isolation. Interestingly enough, occasional experiences in the field of medical practice confirm this insight as it applies to issues of health. Let me give you a case in point. And I take this from Dr. Graham Clark of the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York. He reports in a book on a patient of his who had undergone an eye operation. According to his account, as given in his essay on health and longevity, 2 days after surgery, nothing had changed in the eye from the time that he had operated on it. All the tissues were exactly as he had left them at the time of surgery. A week later, there still was no change. 10 days later, the original condition was beginning to return, for which the operation had been done in the first place. At that point, Dr. Clark sat down with his patient and said to her, "I'm afraid you are under a misapprehension. I am not a healer. I am a surgeon. I put tissues together so that they can heal as they could not if they were separated, but I cannot heal you. I can merely put your eye back together. I must do so again because your eye has come apart again. But if there is to be healing, it will have to be yours and not mine." The patient was delighted finally to have got through all of the medical abstractions and mechanism to a personal relationship by which her doctor was able to call attention to the resources other than those that he had in his medical profession. The second operation took place the next day. 10 days later, this lady was healed. In this particular case, the doctor pointed his patient to the potential for healing in her own faith. I was just reading the other day Doris Kearns's Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. And there's an interesting little paragraph in there about President Johnson's father, who had been taken to a hospital with a heart attack, and all the tubes were inserted and all the machinery stood around him, and he lay there for weeks far away from home. And he finally begged his son Lyndon to take him home on the principle, "I want to go home where people care and where they know when you're dying." Well, Lyndon took his father home. He lived for 2 weeks, but at least he died in a situation where he was thought of and treated as a person. Experiences of this kind suggest the fact that man often does not get well until he gets some understanding of himself in the context provided by his nature, his history, and by the universe which he inhabits. Accordingly, some notice must be taken of the need for man to have some interpretation of himself and of his context. At present, we live in a highly compressed world where there are 6 general views of man, and I owe this particular insight to Dr. Vavra, V-A-V-R-A, and I put the name up here, from Washington University, who did a paper for us once on this particular subject. And he spelled out 6 different views of man. The Darwinian view, Darwin's name is up there, of man in self-directed evolution of body and mind. He went on to Huxley, man in directed, convergent evolution. Martin Buber, men in interrelationship with each other, the I-thou formula that you know. Kierkegaard, man growing through self-knowledge in knowledge of his goal. Teilhard de Chardin, very popular on campuses, especially his book, The Phenomenon of Man. Man in emergent spiritual evolution, the most complex creature there is and most aware of himself. That's what it means he was made in the image of God. Then, of course, the view of Karl Marx, namely of man as part of the cosmic process which secretes its own solutions as it goes along. This is not the time to go into a detailed discussion of these various philosophies, but it's useful to remember that there are all kinds of views of man abroad, and some of them very profound. This is not the time to go into a detailed discussion of these various philosophies, but it's useful to remember that there are all kinds of views of man abroad, and some of them very profound. At the moment, it is enough to realize that each of these interpretations includes a concept of man as unfulfilled, as suffering illness, in need of some kind of help and salvation. They all hint at the transcendent elements in our human context by pointing out that all men seek security of some kind on at least four levels, namely, the security of maximizing pleasures and minimizing pain, the security of a stable means for everyday existence and comfort, the security derived from having goals to work toward, and that of having achieved some kind of immortality. To be deprived of these securities is, in one sense or another, to be unfulfilled or to be ill. Having said all this, we must hasten to observe that with the exception of communism and possibly secularism, which Dr. Vavra, by the way, lists as a single category, these various philosophies operate without any specific interest in what we have called eschatology. That is to say, they don't interpret existence in the light of what has already been accomplished as fulfillment in history and what is yet to come in terms of consummation. Even the exceptions mentioned tend to reduce the force of the transcendent by putting the goal of history within history itself and defining the transcendent as whatever lies ahead, not what is above. In so doing, communism and secularism tend to make an idol of the historical process. For this reason, the gospel would brand these views, and here I'm repeating myself, as idolatrous. At their best, however, they might be looked upon as a kind of preparatio evangelica, a preparation for the gospel, which is inherent in our created order as a witness to the need of the transcendent in the sense of a point of reference beyond man himself. In such a context, the chief value of the gospel is its unambiguous testimony to the nature of this transcendent dimension. We need to look at this witness as it relates to the question of health. We shall do so with the help of the term symbol, S-Y-M-B-O-L, in a somewhat non-technical sense, as a way of suggesting that health is the kind of concept which is best understood from a point of reference outside itself. We shall note as we go along that health looks beyond itself in six ways. In the first place, the very presence of health, any measure of health, even in a minimal sense, is a symbol of God's creative power, of his redemptive intent, and of his willingness to provide us even now with a token of the powers of the age to come. Putting it this way amounts to little more than looking at the problem of health in the light of the three articles of the Creed. There are so many forces of disruption, disorder, and disease at work, both in our environment and within ourselves, that the very existence of some measure of well-being speaks of a stronger power that preserves some order and provides some degree of health in the face of everything which tends to distort and to destroy life. Such testimony, however, offers only a limited degree of hope, for the specter of death haunts the human scene to make the tragic point that no matter how much order and how much health may be given and preserved for a particular moment, that very moment will be swallowed up by life's final foe. In the light of the gospel, therefore, health, in the second place, can also be turned into a symbol of God's redemptive intent. And here we return to the healing miracles to which the Gospels testify. They describe actions that were undertaken to manifest a power great enough to break open the finitude of our situation by means of and in the light of the resurrection. The miracles themselves were acts embodying and exhibiting the fact that God did not create men to be ill, and that whatever disease now prevails among men is part of an existence whose outcome God intends to be salvation. In the third instance, health has become not only a symbol, but even a token of the powers of the age to come. It is here, it would seem, that the incarnation, the crucifixion, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ provide the model for the kind of wholeness that the art of healing would do well to examine. And here I'm talking to the medical profession, very frankly. Under all the anguish, pain, and suffering which men experience, the hidden God is already at work, offering health as a kind of foreshadowing of that wholeness to which we apply the word salvation. And that's probably the reason why the New Testament keeps using this word zozein instead of hygiēs for both health and salvation. Whatever brokenness men may feel and observe has within it the promise of restoration. That's the significance of Good Friday and Easter for the issue before us. Fourthly, as a token, health is also a symbol of our solidarity with the cosmos. As part of our experience and observation, health cannot be fully understood as a gift and as function apart from the gospel proclamation that the total universe, even now, is being brought under the lordship of Jesus Christ. Every individual has been made to take part in this reconciling process. He cannot stand apart from it except by his own deliberate no to God's yes. And the famous passage on that, of course, is Romans 8, where Paul makes the point that all of the created order is awaiting the moment of man's liberation. When seen in the light of this awareness, some measure of the element of tragedy is removed from the problem of the malformed and the defective among us. Beyond and above the saddest of all such cases stands the determination of a gracious God to put all things under subjection to Jesus Christ. This is part of the human context, especially since Easter morning. For at that moment, the whole world stood before God in a new relationship. It was whole, whole. Evil and illness were now overcome in their final potential. God's redemptive will, for what appears to be incomplete and even grotesquely formed, is now bound to prevail. It cannot be stopped. Against the background of this revelation, we may now acquire some degree of comprehension of what follows from the fact that man was made in God's image and was given dominion in the created order. He shows himself to be man, especially as redeemed man, when he takes his responsibilities seriously. He will not be well, we can therefore say, when he remains uninvolved and isolated. We may speak of health, then, under the fifth point, as constituting a symbol of our commitment. Fulfilling this responsibility will, by its very nature, raise the issue of the goals toward which health strives as that condition of man which enables him to achieve certain purposes. Such goals will be seen to include a concern for others and a willingness to be of service to them, to see the other man's need as of more importance than one's own, which of course is the burden of Paul's great Carmen Christi, as it is called, Philippians 2. 5-9, where this is said of Jesus. The crucifixion points to a goal even beyond what we've been saying, namely losing one's life to find it. To be well, therefore, an individual must reckon with his own expendability. Here's another way of saying, with reference to that Carmen Christi, that hymn to the humiliation and exaltation of our Lord, that in the incarnate Christ, we have the model for whatever we may wish to do with health. Being made in the likeness of his Creator and entrusted with the responsibility to represent God in and toward creation, man has the task of engaging in unceasing investigation and research for the purpose of discovering more and more of the secrets God has chosen to hide away in what he has made. It's one of the paradoxes of history, in a sense, that the greatest medical advances have been made in those cultures which have been most influenced by the Christian religion. You might think it would work the other way, that because of the emphasis on the resurrection of the body, there wouldn't be any particular impulse to work toward improvement and advances in medicine. But God, being the creator and having endowed men with this responsibility of further investigation into his secrets, there have been these technological advances. And they provide evidence, even though indirect, of the creator's ultimate intent for his creation. The fact that man can discover, invent, and create speaks of his sharing in this destiny. As a redeemed person, he will want to put the results of his various creative pursuits to work in the interest of that reconciliation whose limitless dimensions were exhibited on the cross. The revelation of St. John, by the way, that word is singular, revelation, apocalypse, of St. John, gives us a clue to the outcome of health as gift and function applied to the work of reconciliation. In light of this hint, we may speak of health, and this is now point six, as the symbol of that liturgical response in which those saints engage whose robes have been washed white in the blood of the Lamb. That is to say, health as we now have it, and as it extends forward into salvation, can be viewed as the kind of endowment intended to urge us on to participate with the communion of saints here in anticipating and preparing for the prospect that lies before us of that undefiled and unending worship in the presence of our Creator, Redeemer, and Sanctifier. In short, this is a call again for the Christian congregation to become a healing community, which is a desperate need for our day, and it is a hope that stretches beyond the days of our present existence and is nurtured within the worldwide fellowship that is known as the church. The very existence of this community of the people of God, combined with new insights which the Holy Spirit provides, both in and through the experience of theologians, missionaries, medical people, makes this an age of great opportunity. It is one of those moments in the history of the church when both the necessity and the possibility of creating new strategies are put within the reach of God's people. And just a few weeks ago, I came across a very little item in Concordia, Missouri, to illustrate how a Christian congregation can, in a very simple, ordinary way, become a healing community. St. Paul's Church in Concordia, Missouri, has the practice of conducting once a month a public service in the church building of all of the elderly people who are still able to get around somewhat, provided other people are there to bring them. Two things are going on, or maybe even three. One group of people is being asked and trained to bring these people to the service. Secondly, these individuals living in an often frightening isolation are brought together into a community of their likes and of their peers. And thirdly, they assemble in the presence of word and sacrament to receive the highest of all gifts, namely the forgiveness of sins. Well, that's a simple illustration of how a Christian congregation, in the present context, with our needs, has become a healing community without probably being aware of all of the jargon and the fancy talk we've been engaged in. There's much truth in what Canon Warren has written in the introduction to John Taylor's book of some years ago, The Primal Vision, and I quote him. Christians are being presented by the contemporary world with what is in many ways a unique opportunity of demonstrating the gospel. Scarcely less unique is the opportunity being offered to them of discovering in a new and deeper way what the gospel is. It is the opportunity to demonstrate the fundamental truth of the gospel, that it is a universal message whose relevance is not limited to any one culture, to any one system of thought, to any one pattern of activity. Looking at everything around us, especially man with his problems in isolation, I think we can confidently say that the hour of the church has come, not in the sense of any dazzling success that people will recognize and for which they will engage public relations departments, but as occasion's opportunity for service.